You're listening to Open for Discussion, a University of Sydney podcast that discusses research through a personal and critical lens. I'm your host, Chris Neff. Usually we begin each discussion with a question to our guest, but today I'd like to begin with a question to our listeners. What do you know about insects, slime mold, and other brainless organisms? Did you know that they comprise the majority of life on Earth? Did you know they inform next-generation engineering, optimal transport systems, and help us build resilient metropolises? With me today is Dr. Tanya Ladi, an entomologist and head of the Insect Behavior and Ecology Lab at the University of Sydney's School of Life and Environmental Sciences. Thank you for joining us, Tanya.
Thanks for having me.
So can I begin by asking how you got into insects? This is a niche within a niche, but it's fantastic.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's a great job. I don't really remember when I got into insects. It's sort of always been that way since I was a little kid, catching things and bringing them home to my parents, and then they'd escape and they'd freak out. They're fascinating organisms. They're hyper diverse. You've got insects that can eat almost anything you can imagine. They, you know, some of them have wings, some of them are burrowing in the ground. And really, if you like animals, insects make up 75% of animal life. So you kind of have to like insects too.
Insects make up 75% of animal life?
At least 75%. It's probably higher than that because we haven't actually identified the vast majority of insects on the planet.
That's brilliant. So how popular is entomology? Do we know much about insects?
Well, I'd say entomology is relatively popular. You get lots of really strong communities of amateurs going out and catching butterflies and bees. But we actually know very, very little about insects in general. So I'm going to ask you a question. How many species, how many different types of insects do you reckon there are on the planet?
Oh, gosh. I'm on the spot. There are many species.
Well, there's about 1 million that we've identified, but we estimate there's between 5 and 10 million species of insects altogether. I mean, that's huge. But what should be really striking there is that we don't really know. So between 5 and 10 million, that's a huge, huge difference. So we've probably only identified at best maybe 20% of them. And not just in rainforests and things. There is this neat study a few years ago in LA where they got citizen scientists to put up collectors all over their backyards. And they found 30 new species of insects in, you know, urban LA. So this highly urbanized city, by no means is this like a rainforest of diversity, and 30 new species. So there's lots of insects and we know almost nothing about most of them. You know, again, 25% of animal life are beetles. I mean, they're the biggest group of organisms that we have.
So 75% of the animal life was insects, mm-hmm. and then 25% of that is beetles alone?
Well, 25% of animals are beetles, so not 25% of insects, 25% of basically everything. So most animals are beetles, really. Beetles are in charge of the world.
Okay, very interesting. Now, can I ask you about slime mold?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, because I'm wondering what they are and why they're important.
Well, slime molds are probably the closest thing we have to aliens on the planet. They are so bizarre. They're like, if you imagine just a gigantic blob of moving mucus, that's pretty much what a slime mold is. So they have no brain, they have no neurons, they have no central information processing of any kind. But we know from experiments by some of my collaborators in Japan that they can solve mazes, for example. And more than that, if you take a map of a metro system, so in this case it was the Tokyo metro system, and you put little bits of food over all the stations and then let the slime mold connect up those points however it wants to, it typically will be able to connect those exactly like the metro system that we actually use. So I mean, this takes engineers and computers lots of time to come up with these, yet the slime mold's able to do it despite the fact it has no brain. And so a lot of the research I've been doing in my group is to try to understand, first of all, how slime molds are able to do anything at all, really, given that they have no brains, but also to start to look at the huge numbers of different behaviors and problems that slime molds can solve despite the fact they have no brain. But most people don't even know that they exist.
So where should we look to find a slime mold?
Weirdly,
I've probably been missing slime molds my whole life and I didn't know it.
Well, you're not alone. So I've got a student currently who's going out and sampling to try to learn a bit about slime mold ecology. And she just goes out and finds leaf litter. So leaf litter in the city and basically anywhere. And she's starting to find slime molds there. Weirdly, one of the best sources of slime molds I found are dried banana peels. No idea why.
Oh, okay. Very interesting. Now, can I ask you a personal question?
Oh, that's worrying. Yes.
What is your favorite insect and why?
That's a really hard question to answer because some days I love praying mantises. Today, I'd say probably my favorite is a species of ant called a meat ant. Meat ants are all over Australia. They're pretty aggressive. So if you harass them, they all come running out and try to bite you. But they build really cool transportation networks by cutting all the grass along their path, their trails. So right now I'm kind of fascinated by meat ants. I'd say they're my favorite, but some days it's cockroaches, some days it's mantises. It's kind of all over the map. There's so much to like in the insects. It's hard to pick.
How much of your work focuses on ants?
Yeah, a lot of it. It depends. It sort of varies year to year, but ants are super important for a lot of ecosystems. They also have really cool behaviors. So for example, ants have evolved agriculture. So there's several different species of ants that actually have what are very similar to farms. In some of them, it's these little tiny sap-sucking insects called aphids that suck out plant juices, and they secrete this sort of sugary food source that the ants harvest, kind of the way human farmers look after cows, dairy cows. And they'll protect those herds of aphids from predators. They'll move them to better places if they need to. In some species, those aphids are so important for the colony that when a new queen is born and she's flying off to go start her own colony, she'll actually take one of the little aphids with her to start a new herd. I mean, it's amazing when you think that most species of ants have brains smaller than the head of a pin, yet they've got these sophisticated colonies, sophisticated systems that they're able to run.
Can I ask, what is the research application of the work that you're doing? So when you're dealing with ants or you're dealing with slime molds?
Well, one of the things we're really interested in is trying to take ideas from these natural systems and then apply them to human systems. So for example, we know that ants are running these amazing decentralized societies where, you know, nobody's in charge and there's no blueprint, yet they're able to run all of these things. And it would be great if we could take some of that and use it to apply, say, our increasingly decentralized computer systems, for example. We can also learn about how to build better transportation systems, for example. So we're trying to apply that. And to do that, I work a lot with computer scientists, people in civil engineering, mathematicians, to try to make that transition from things we learn about the natural world and put it onto human systems.
So how often do you see the behavior of, you know, ants or a bee swarm and you think, okay, this is a group of people or I've seen this behavior?
Yeah, well, that part happens all the time. So there's lots of times when I'm watching a natural system and I go, oh, that's brilliant. We can use that. The difficulty then, though, is really taking it and making it something that works for humans. Because, of course, ants aren't humans. They're optimizing different things. It's more that if we figure out how brainless systems are able to do these kinds of problems, we can take those algorithms that are driving their behavior, and then we can use those to optimize our systems instead, especially for these really large-scale optimization problems where our current computer algorithms struggle a little bit. So we're not asking the systems directly. We're using them as inspiration to extract algorithms that we can then use. One of the best examples is something called an ant colony optimization algorithm based on the way ants harvest food. So when an ant finds a really nice food source, she lays this chemical trail back to her nest, and the other ants will find that trail and allows them to focus on food sources. They took that general idea and then started using it to optimize computer systems. So we're trying to find other versions of that and new examples that we can use.
What do you think? What would be the dream application of the work that you're doing based on what you know?
Okay. I think if everything went exactly the way I'd like it to go, I'd love to be able to look back in, say, 5 years and say, here's an algorithm that we developed from watching, say, the meat ants optimize their transportation networks. Or now we're using it to help coordinate autonomous vehicles so that we reduce traffic load. That would be kind of the dream application, I think.
It seems like there's a lot that we can learn from the resilience of these different insects or different creatures. What are some examples of the bio-inspired engineering that are built in our cities?
Oh, well, one of the really good examples is architecture. So there's a building in Harare, Zimbabwe, that was inspired by the termite mounds you get in the deserts. because it gets so hot and so dry in the desert, these termite mounds have this passive cooling system that allows them to expel heat and keep the middle of the colony at a nice constant temperature, no matter how hot, well, within certain ranges of temperatures outside. And so architects took that general idea of passive cooling and built buildings that can now do the same thing. So they're able to use a lot less air conditioning, even on hot days, than a normal building would be able to. So it's really about looking at all of these systems, figuring out what they do really well, and then picking and choosing our inspiration. Because at the end of the day, we know very, very, very little about the vast majority of ant and bee species out there. So there could be all sorts of inspiration just hiding there that we're just missing because we haven't started to study them. So we really need to start looking and embracing that huge diversity of solutions that could be out there.
You're listening to Open for Discussion, a University of Sydney podcast that discusses research through a personal and critical lens. I'm your host, Chris Neff. Today, I'm having a fascinating discussion with entomologist Dr. Tanya Laddie. Tanya, can I ask about some of the other areas that you work in and what some of the other applications of your research are?
Sure. So we currently have a student looking at how we can rear insects as a form of protein. So not only for livestock, but potentially for humans. Insects are really high in protein. They're low in fat. You can rear heaps of them with a very small environmental footprint, and you can rear them anywhere. So you can imagine having, you know, skyscrapers of mealworm farms in the middle of your city without using any new agricultural land. But in particular, we're super interested about being able to develop techniques for rearing insects on waste streams. So for example, all the things that get thrown out during agriculture, all the things that people throw out, so food scraps, things that we would normally compost, we might be able to use those to rear insects that we can then feed either to our livestock or potentially even to ourselves. So it's a nice way of being able to close that loop and make everything more efficient and more sustainable.
Can we just pause on the food, insect food?
Yum.
I mean, because put it in a bar. I mean, that's all I'm saying is if you're going to do insect protein, put it in a bar. I'll eat anything. I'm American. I'll eat anything you put in a chocolate bar.
Yep. There's lots of chocolate covered insects. Actually, dry roasted with chili powder, crickets, pretty good.
Okay. All right.
That's noted. My recommendation to you.
Can I follow up for a moment? You said bioconverters to deal with waste streams. Can you tell us a little bit more about it? Is this something you're doing with the Behavior and Ecology Lab?
Yes, this is pretty cool stuff because we generate heaps and heaps of waste. Most of it goes to landfill. And it turns out that insects are really good. Well, some species of insect are really good at breaking down that food waste and turning it into protein, which we can then use to feed livestock or people. So we've got projects on a species of insect called a black soldier fly. They're really good at breaking down food wastes. They end up being very high in protein, so you can feed them to things. There's research in other labs, really exciting new research that shows that this little caterpillar called a waxworm can degrade plastics. Other experiments have shown that, say, mealworms can break down styrofoam. So there's this huge potential that we could be using insects to break down all of these products rapidly. And then hopefully we can actually use the insects themselves for protein. So it's kind of a new area we've started getting into. We've got a few students working on different aspects of getting those types of bioconversion systems up and running for waste management and protein production.
Well, this sounds like very exciting research, and we're lucky to have you here at the University of Sydney to learn more about sort of animal systems and the way that they impact human systems. Can I ask about bees? What can bees tell us?
Yeah, so we've studied a few different aspects of bee behavior. On one hand, it's interesting to watch how bees choose amongst lots of different flowers, because in a bee in an environment, there's lots of different patches of flowers, and the bees are very, very good at selecting the most rewarding patches. They do this by this really incredible communication mechanism they have called a waggle dance. And so a bee, by waggle dancing, it's able to tell the bees following that dance the direction of a food source relative to the sun. So the bees know exactly where to go. The length of a waggle tells the observing bees how far to travel and how excitedly they kind of do that dance, and how many circuits they do tells them how good that resource is. So they have this really neat communication system that lets them exploit patches of good food really quickly. And so, again, part of what we do is trying to understand how resilient that system is in terms of what happens when you disrupt the communication system, what happens when the environment changes, and then trying to get a sense of the algorithms that those bee colonies are using. And of course, bees are super important for pollination. So 75% of our crops are pollinated by bees, and almost everything that we like to eat, all the delicious crops, are insect pollinated. So we really need to get a handle on bee systems. And so our work is partly learning about bees and other systems that we can use what we learn from them in technology systems. Another strand of our research is trying to understand, say, the resilience of honeybee colonies so that we can understand why they collapse sometimes and then maybe prevent that.
The conservationist in me asks one overall question, which is, if any of this is going to work, if you're going to learn from them, be inspired by them, be able to apply it to any kind of human activity, then you have to appreciate it and then not treat it as a pest species that you want to eradicate or that you let passively or actively go extinct. To what extent is that an issue? Because you sort of mentioned that we know about millions of species, but there's lots that we don't know.
Yeah, I think the big risk is that we are starting to lose species at a really alarming rate. Some of those species will never have had names, and most of them will never have been studied. So even if from a totally selfish sort of not thinking about biodiversity angle, we are losing all of that information. We're losing all of that potential inspiration, and we don't even know that it exists. So it's a huge problem, I think. And, you know, it's not that it's the only reason that we should conserve biodiversity. But again, from a selfish perspective, it's a good reason. We need to look after the planet a lot better than we are.
That's a great note to leave it on. But thank you so much for joining us on Open for Discussion, Dr. Tanya Laddie.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for joining us on Open for Discussion. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or SoundCloud. And you can find me on Twitter at Christopher Neff. If you'd like to know more about our research, be sure to visit our website, sydney.edu.au/news.